on the bottom of it. And so I thought I'd share with you, as we are starting to think this morning a bit about leadership and what it means to lead, share with you some of the appraisals that have been released for some of those officers that maybe you wouldn't want to follow quite so much. His men would follow him anywhere, but only out of curiosity. This officer is not really so much of a has-been, but more of a definitely won't be. When she opens her mouth, it seems this is only to change whichever foot was previously in there. Out of his depth in a car park puddle. He has carried out each and every one of his duties to his entire satisfaction. This young woman has delusions of adequacy. He sets low personal standards and then consistently fails to achieve them. This man is depriving a village somewhere of an idiot. And then my favourite, I would not breed from this officer. Now, leadership is obviously all the rage at the moment. Whatever you might think about England's marvellous football run, there's been lots of discussion about Gareth Southgate. I'm not wearing the waistcoat, it's far too hot. But lots of discussion about how we've got there, not just because Harry Kane is wonderful and all his other mates, but actually because of the leadership of Gareth Southgate and what he is doing in terms of leading the team, both on the pitch and off it. And therefore, I wonder what you think a model church minister might be like. For some of you, he might be a bit Vicar of Dibley-esque, you know, quite nice, fluffy person, gets involved in the local community, lots of meetings about social issues. Perhaps for some of us, a model minister should be spending a large chunk of the week visiting all kinds of different folk. Others would think a minister needs to understand the felt needs of the congregation and then seek to meet them. For others, Bible teaching, evangelism would be important. So as well as spending hours in the study, preparing quality sermons and training others to teach the Bible, our minister will be running evangelistic courses, building up relationships with non-Christians and modelling personal evangelism. So one of the other issues, of course, is that we mustn't forget spirituality and wisdom. For some of us, our model minister needs to have super spiritual wisdom to know how to respond to all kinds of feedback. Because sometimes he or she receives positive or affirming feedback, but often the feedback is critical. Because the only perfect minister, of course, was Jesus himself. But our model minister needs to be able to distinguish between that constructive critical feedback that we all give him or her and the negative criticisms other people give him who are consciously or subconsciously opposing the gospel. And that brings us back to Paul and first century Thessalonica. So if you're not there already, find 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and let's start looking at this passage. So verse 2, Paul says, we had previously suffered and been treated outrageously in Philippi, as you know. But with the help of God, we dare to tell you his gospel in the face of strong opposition. So when we looked at chapter 1 a couple of weeks ago, we saw that Paul's ministry was strongly opposed. He'd arrived in Thessalonica from Philippi, where he'd been given an illegal beating for preaching the gospel. He'd only been in Thessalonica a few months when he'd been hounded out by a renter mob, in fact, by a mob who'd been whipped up by those who rejected his message. And so Paul had to leave this group of very young Christians, this fledgling church, and had to leave this baby church under intense persecution. And the pressure this church was under wasn't just external violent persecution. No, perhaps it was also subject to more subtle pressures. Because as we're going to see, what Paul is doing in these verses is defending himself against a barrage of criticism. Complaints and criticisms aimed at Paul, yes, but also, therefore, by implication, aimed at these young Thessalonian Christians. People will be saying, you know, this guy Paul, he's well dodgy. He's a slimy hit-and-run religious salesman. And you've been duped, you Christians. Don't tell me you actually gave him some money. He's just dashed in from Philippi, spent a few months here, and now he's off. Doesn't care about you. He's simply playing a numbers game. You know, bums on seats and money in the plate. That's the name of his game. And that would ring a bit of a call, because in first century Greece at that time, there were loads of travelling religious teachers. Because the Greeks loved to listen to the latest religious and philosophical ideas. And so there's a bit of a profession. There was some money to be made here. And the first century travelling religious speakers expected to be paid by their audience. Just like a busker or a street performer today. At the end of their talk, they would pass the hat round, and people, by and large, coughed up with a few shekels. And if the speaker was good, they could make a decent living out of such speaking. But if you were a travelling religious teacher, and you had to work, you know, part-time in Tesco to pay the gas bill, well, you can't be any good then, can you? That was the perception in first century Thessalonica. And the church, therefore, was under huge, subtle pressure. Paul was simply another travelling religious salesman, they were being told. He's been, said his piece, been paid, and look, he's gone. You're not meant to take it seriously, you Christians. It's just another piece of religious entertainment. You've been duped. You actually believe this stuff Paul was going on about. This stuff about there being another king called Jesus, another God more powerful than Caesar. Because remember, the mob would say, you can believe whatever religion you want, as long as it doesn't affect the way you live. You can believe any religion you like, as long as Caesar is still Lord. Indeed, as long as Caesar is still the most important God. So come on. Come on, you Thessalonian Christians. Let's go back. Let's go back to the synagogue. Let's go back to Caesar's temple. Let's just forget this guy Paul and this silly Christian thing again. We'll forget the embarrassing little episode ever happened, and we'll get on with life in the real world. Welcome to first century Thessalonica. The kind of pressure the church was under, the kind of criticism that was being thrown around by Paul. And so after Paul gives thanks to this church in chapter 1, in chapter 2 he starts defending himself. Defends his ministry, and in the process he outlines model ministry for us. Model ministry and model leadership. And so we're going to see three areas of this model ministry. Now at this point, if I were Adrian, there would be a fantastic set of slides coming up. Videos, colour, beautiful fonts, things of beauty and grace and wonder. That's not happening today. The first point begins with an I. So here is my slightly more low-tech. We have three I's today and not a slide in sight. The first I is about instruction in the message. Instruction in the message. So Paul's writing, you know, brothers, he says right at the beginning of that passage, you know that our visit to you was not without results. It wasn't a failure. Literally, he's saying our coming to you was not in vain. I'm not a waste of space, says Paul, and neither was my message. It had results. It had concrete results. You, the church, those who responded to the message. So what was Paul's message that he needed to instruct them in? Well, in verse 2, he says literally that he had boldness to tell them the gospel of God. The gospel of God, and that's a phrase that comes up again if you look in verse 8, verse 9, back in verse 4, he talks about the gospel. And then he implies the gospel of God in verses 3 and 12. So in every other verse of this passage, Paul is reminding us of the message of the gospel of God. Not Paul's gospel, not saying he's made up in the shower one morning, but the gospel of God. And that gospel, that good news, God's good news. And the good news is important. Every section of 1 Thessalonians concludes with a reference to the second coming. If you have a flick through, you'll see that. Paul is really concerned about the return of the Lord Jesus. And as we'll find out when we get to chapter 4, for lots of people, when the Lord Jesus returns, that will be bad news. Because when Jesus returns to wind up human history, the whole human race will be judged. And the pass mark for God's judgment is perfection. And if you don't pass, if you're not perfect, then as the end of chapter 1 puts it, you'll be facing the wrath of Jesus. For those who haven't perfectly obeyed God's laws, they will face a just eternity of God's wrath. Now, although it's good to know that there is going to be ultimate justice in this world, good to know that evildoers won't get away with it forever, it's also bad news for all of us too, because, you know, none of us are perfect. None of us meet God's perfect standards. And so, left to ourselves, we'd all be facing God's wrath against our sins. And so the real good news, as we saw in chapter 1 last time, is the gospel of God. The gospel of God, which, for those of us who accept that offer, for Christians that is, and for Christians alone, Jesus promises to rescue us from the coming wrath. He took the punishment that we deserve, so that we don't have to. That's what the cross is all about. That's the good news about Jesus, the gospel of God, and that's Paul's message. Indeed, that's what Paul spent his time doing, preaching and teaching the gospel. And he uses a variety of ways of doing that. There's a number of verbs, doing words, that he uses to show how he is putting over this message, how he is instructing people in this message. Firstly, verse 2, we see Paul telling the Thessalonians about the gospel of God. Literally, he's speaking or declaring it. It's an umbrella term for all kinds of speaking in many and various ways. How else does Paul get across this wonderful message? Verse 3, we see Paul appealing to them, literally exhorting them, where exhortation implies an intellectual or logical discussion, a sort of first century Christianity explored, where people sit down and discuss the gospel of God. Then verse 8, where Paul talks about sharing the gospel. We loved you so much that we were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well. The idea here is that Paul is sharing the gospel in a more casual setting, one-to-one, down the pub, with his friends, with his neighbours, in someone's home. Paul sharing the gospel in the context of relationships with real people. Then in verse 9, we work night and day, he says, in order not to be a burden to anyone while we preach the gospel of God to you. Paul preached the gospel of God. And the word preach has a sense of public preaching to a large group. In the synagogue, in the streets, maybe in Jason's house, which might become a sort of impromptu house church. Paul preached the gospel. And then finally, in verse 12, we see Paul encouraging and urging, almost shouting at people. There was a lot of shouting at the telly yesterday afternoon. Urging and encouraging it. I must tell you this, it's not quite on the point, but it's quite funny. You might have seen that when the goals were scored yesterday, they quite often, the BBC quite often show groups of people, you know, cheering and throwing their beer in the air. And they, you know, they went round all round the country, and the goals went in, and everybody started cheering. And then they showed the General Synod, which is meeting at the moment, Church of England General Synod, and the goals went up and all the bishops, you know, started cheering. And apparently the Bishop of Willesden was heard to yell a number of times, "Will you close down your man, Maguire, quickly," at the screen, encouraging, exhorting, urging. A mixture, Paul is using a mixture of positive teaching styles, all aimed at getting this wonderful message across. So he does it in lots of different ways. Paul telling, sharing, preaching the gospel, appealing to people's intellects, encouraging, exhorting, and urging them to respond with their emotions as well as their minds. Paul's ministry priority, just like Jesus's, was preaching and teaching the Bible. And so that's the first mark of our model ministry: instruction in the message. Instruction in the message. Right, back to the laser display centre. For the second I, our second I is integrity of motives and methods. Integrity of motives and methods. The mud was really being slung at Paul, wasn't it? Paul, you're a bit of a dodgy, money-grabbing TV evangelist. You know, you can't be trusted. Look with me at verse 3, which literally says, Paul is saying, "For our exhortation doesn't come from error or impurity or deceit." In other words, Paul is saying, the message I preach is correct. It's God's gospel, after all, not mine. We've learnt that already. I've preached it clearly and plainly. I've not used manipulative techniques or emotional blackmail or some sort of psychological pressure. Yes, I've urged you very strongly to follow Jesus. Why? Because without Jesus, says Paul, you're heading for a lost eternity. But I've been straight with you. My methods have been pure and above board. I've not been into flattery. I'm not in it for the money. No, I've simply engaged with people and I've answered their questions. I've not forced anyone to become a Christian. On the contrary, says Paul in verse 4, we speak as those approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel. We're not trying to please people, but God, who tests our heart. We're not looking for praise from people, he says in verse 6, not from you or anyone else. Approved by God means tested. Tested in a sense of being refined in the fire of Christian ministry. Remember, Paul had been flogged and imprisoned in Philippi. He'd been hounded out of town by a rent-a mob. In his ministry, Paul had faced every possible discouragement and persecution. He'd been shipwrecked, stoned, flogged, imprisoned, and ridiculed everywhere he went. He certainly wasn't in the ministry for an easy life. So why did he do it? Why did he keep going back for more and more hassle? Well, simple. He believed he was commissioned by God. He'd been approved and tested by God. And he had a message from God that people needed to hear. And so he would try every legitimate method to persuade people. To persuade people to accept this wonderful gospel. But if they chose not to, then that was their right. Paul wasn't building some ecclesiastical empire. He wasn't seeking people's approval. Because ultimately, people's opinions didn't matter. What mattered was God's approval. And in Christian ministry, our motives and our methods need to match our message. There's no point having this wonderful gospel of God that God has entrusted us with if we don't have pure and upright motives and methods when we seek to share it. In the Christian ministry, means do matter. Means do not always are justified by the ends. So, that's our second I. Integrity of method and motive. And then back to the laser display screen for our third eye. Our third eye, after instruction in the message, integrity of motive and methods. Our third eye is intensity of relationships. Intensity of relationships. And that's the third mark of a model ministry. Remember the criticism, Paul, the hit and run evangelist, he doesn't care about you folk, he's only after the money. And so Paul tries to refute these criticisms one by one. First of all, the money issue. As ministers of Christ, Paul and Silas and Timothy and the others who were with him, all three of them could have been a burden to the Thessalonians. Burden here not in a negative sense, but in the sense that they had a right to be paid by the Thessalonians for the gospel work they were doing. Now, Paul explains elsewhere in the New Testament the general principle that a full-time gospel worker should be funded properly to allow them to get on with the job. And over the past few weeks and months here at Crofton, we've been thinking, haven't we, about our budget and about our giving. And if you remember from the budget presentation, a large proportion of our giving here goes to our staff. But in Thessalonica, in the first century, Paul gives up the right to be paid. So why does he do that? Well, remember those travelling religious teachers of the day? Paul gave up his right to a church salary in order to put some clear blue water between him and the charlatans. Look at verse 9. By trade, Paul was a tent maker. So by day, he preached the gospel, and at night, he made tents in order to pay the bills. Why? So he could stand up and say, I'm not like them. I'm not in it for the money. So here we have Paul, the model minister, the model Christian indeed, the one who gives up his rights for the sake of the gospel. So that's the money issue. What about this hit and run issue? You know, Paul, you just come into our town, you've done your bit, and now you've disappeared. Well, in verse 8, Paul declares his love for the Thessalonian Christians. True, he'd only been with them a few months, but he loved them dearly. And he uses the picture of a mother and father to demonstrate the depth of his love for them. Back in verse 7, he says that he was gentle like a breastfeeding mother with her newborn baby. That's how he sees himself, as a spiritual midwife bringing baby Christians to birth. And then as a breastfeeding mother, feeding them with the pure spiritual milk of the gospel. And as that baby Christian begins to develop and grow, then Paul uses this picture in verse 12 of a devoted father. A devoted father who exhorts, who encourages, and urges his children. Those baby Christians have matured a bit in Thessalonica. They've moved on from just spiritual milk to more solid biblical teaching. And indeed, Paul does some more of that in-depth teaching in chapters 4 and 5, which we'll be looking at in the weeks to come. But the main point here is that Paul is no hit-and-run evangelist. He doesn't treat people as evangelistic targets. He doesn't treat Christians as mere pew fodder. Not after their money. No, Paul teaches the Bible in the context of relationships. He doesn't just teach the Bible, he teaches people the Bible. And so should we. Model ministry is ultimately about people and not programs. It's about relationships and not statistics. And it will involve an intensity of relationships. For those kinds of relationships don't develop overnight, do they? They take time and effort and sacrifice. For those kinds of relationships to be real, we've got to work at them. And in our frantically busy world, time for building quality relationships is in short supply. And that brings us back to the beginning. Paul's definition of a model ministry. It's about instruction in the message. It's about integrity of motives and methods. It's about intensity of our relationships with one another. Now then, what about our ministers and our minister? We all know what we want from our minister. An online survey listed all the qualities that people expect from perfect pastors. Perfect pastors apparently preach for exactly 12 minutes. Perfect pastors are 28 years of age, but have been preaching for 30 years. Perfect pastors work from 8 a.m. to midnight every day, but are also the caretaker. They frequently condemn sin, but never upset anyone. They wear good clothes, buy good books, drive a good car, are good looking, give generously to the poor, and have a very low salary. They make 15 daily calls to parish families, visit the housebound and the hospitalised, spend all their time evangelising the unchurched, and are always in the office when I need them. Doesn't really work like that, does it? Not in the real world. And we know there's no such thing as a perfect pastor. And so we need to pray for Adrian. Adrian and June are away on holiday this week, but we do need to pray for them. Pray for Adrian as he leads us with all the difficult decisions that that means, with all the demands on his time, with all the loneliness that being a Christian leader also entails. And thank God. Thank God for his gifts, for his dedication, and for his ability to lead us. But this isn't a passage just about leaders, because that would be too easy just to say, well, this is all about somebody else. Firstly, lots of us lead in different ways, don't we? We lead different groups, different organisations, and in different ways in our church. Christian ministry is also not just about the minister. The Bible teaches us that as Christians, we're all ministers. Biblical ministry is every member ministry. And so, Paul's model of ministry applies to us who are Christians. There are no passengers among the members of a church. God calls each and every one of us to minister in some form. It might be a very obvious upfront ministry, maybe a more supporting ministry. But whatever we're doing, however much or however little, we are still going to need these qualities if we are going to model what it means to be a Christian man or woman in the 21st century. If we are keen to see our friends and family become Christians, if we're keen to see God grow his church right here, right now, then we're going to need our three eyes. We're going to need some instruction in the message, in this gospel of God. We're going to need integrity in our motives and our methods as we share that gospel with those around us. And we're going to need to build those relationships so they are intense and true. How do you and I measure up to that model? It's a difficult question, but it's important if we're going to see God do his work here. And maybe we need to ask, what do we need to change in order to become more like the model ministers that God has called us to be? Let's pray together.